Hi, my name is June. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I first really want to thank all of you and the convention committee for allowing me to be part of your conference. I've already enjoyed myself tremendously today, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the conference. I believe that conventions are very, very special. They have been very, very special for me throughout the years that I've been sober. Something special happens for me at conventions, and I believe that it happens for most of us, and so I highly recommend conventions. In fact, there's been many a week in my sobriety where I've felt like I didn't need a meeting, I needed a convention, you know. So after the plane trip I had yesterday, I needed a convention, and I'm delighted to be at this one. I want to welcome anyone here who may be new or visiting, and I want to start out by saying the most important thing I'll say all afternoon. That way you won't have to listen to the whole talk, because I never, you know, could, especially when I was new. Sometimes I can't now. But I want to let you know that I'm not an authority or an expert on alcoholism, on Alcoholics Anonymous, or really on anything else, certainly not on anything I'm going to be sharing about today. I'm just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to stand up here for a little while. I'm going to share my experience, strength, and hope, as the big book suggests that we do. I want to make sure... also, that there's one other very important thing that you know, and that is that Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely free. Had Alcoholics Anonymous not been free when I came here, I never could have come. Had it not remained free, I never could have stayed. You know, and I was well over 10 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before I was financially able to put a dollar in the basket on anything like a regular basis. And I want you to know that I know so many people find Alcoholics Anonymous these days through a lot of different ways, sometimes in treatment centers and different facilities that cost them a lot of money. And that's okay. I don't think it matters how we get here, but I want to be sure you know that there's a difference between where you may have found it and the way that it is here, and it is absolutely free, and I'm very grateful for that. I also really want to thank Joan and Janet for picking me and my family up at the airport. That was asking them to go beyond any lengths, and I really, really appreciated it. I've had a lot of fun this morning already, meeting some new friends and seeing a few old ones like Bob and running into Annette and, you know, some people I hadn't seen in a long, long time. I live a life today that I never would have wanted, and I'm a person today that I wouldn't have even liked when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet I'm happier than I've ever been, and I was never a happy person. I think, you can't hear? When I go like this. Oh boy, I don't know if I can not go like that. okay, I'll try here. Let's see. Now it's going to throw me off. Yeah, I'm from California. We always go like this. I'm one of those people that my first obsession in life was not alcohol, it was suicide. I began to try and kill myself on a regular basis from the time that I was 5 years old. And I don't believe that there were any days that went by before I came to this program that I didn't try and take my own life, put myself in a position where someone else would take my life, or pray to a God that I was slowly losing faith in to please let me die. And as I look back on my life in the years that I've been sober, I know that some of my suicide attempts were a way of trying to get attention, but for the most part, they were sincere. I genuinely wanted to die. And I realize that many of you here in Alcoholics Anonymous will not relate to that, and that's okay, because the big book tells me that I have to share my experience, you know, and that's what I'm here to talk about. I'm very grateful that I found alcohol when I did. I started to drink on a regular basis when I was 8 years old. I had already been using drugs for a year at that time. By the time I was 9, I found a combination that I never altered in any way. That was alcohol and barbiturates or sleeping pills or downers or whatever you might know them as, because the combined effect of those got me where I wanted to go. I have never had a social drink in my life, nor have I ever wanted one. I have never not gotten drunk. I have never not overdosed. That was the way that that it was for me. If you drank the way that I did and used the way that I did, then you don't have a very exciting drunkalogue either. I did a lot of throwing up. I did a lot of passing out, and that's really most of all that I did. I didn't drink to feel good or to have a good time. I was not a party girl, and I know, again, that many of you don't identify with that. But I drank so that I didn't have to feel anything at all, and that was how alcohol worked for me. And I'm extremely grateful that I found it, because I believe that the kind of person that I was, I would have had to have been locked up in some kind of an institution had I not found alcohol and the chemicals that I mixed with it, because I couldn't take it out there. It just always hurt way too much for me. You know, I grew up in an alcoholic family. I knew a lot about alcoholism firsthand. I knew about the broken promises. There was a lot of violence in my home. There was a lot of the same things that go on in anybody else's alcoholic home. And I did not see alcoholism as a disease. I saw it as a weakness. And in my life, those things that I was to decide were weaknesses were some of the toughest old ideas that I had to work through here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a little kid, I looked around. I was an observer of people. And the way that I saw the world, I saw that the men and the women in the world were handling the exact same situations completely differently. Before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've seen men shot, I've seen them stabbed, I've seen them beaten up, I've seen them arrested, I've seen their kids overdose, their wives leave them, I've seen them go through any number of different experiences, and I never saw a man cry under any of those circumstances, to the best of my recollection, before coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. On the other hand, I saw women go through every one of those experiences. Many of them didn't cry. Most of them did at one point or another. And I took that to mean that women feel pain and men don't. And I spent my whole life trying to be what I thought a man was. And to me, a man was someone who cared about no one, who felt absolutely nothing. And if they did, they never let anyone know it. The only exception, the only emotion that I ever saw men experiencing and that I believed that they ever experienced was anger and rage. And that was the way that I tried to live my life. That was the only emotion that was acceptable for me as I saw myself. The problem with that was that I was one of those people that seemed to have been born, as I've heard Clancy talk about, as a person without any insulation whatsoever for my feelings. So that from my very earliest memories when I was out there in the world and kids would tease me about being tall or being skinny or having curly red hair or where I came from or what my mother did or didn't do or whatever it was, I can remember feeling like I was being cut up inside with a knife. And I can remember wanting to start to cry or even sometimes starting to cry. And so my earliest memories about myself, I learned that I was the thing that I hated the most in the entire world. I was weak. I couldn't control my emotions. And I never forgave myself for that. Fortunately, again, for me, with the use of alcohol, I was able to control my emotions. I was able to be the person, the only person I ever wanted to be, which was someone who cared about nothing, who felt absolutely nothing, and if they did, never let anyone know it. I spent my life, I was never good, I never had any tolerance whatsoever for emotional pain. I had a tremendous tolerance for physical pain, and I spent a good deal of my life trying to make sure I was receiving physical pain so that I could avoid emotional pain. And I walked around with my face beat in a lot, and it was okay. I would much rather you punch me in the face than hurt my feelings. And I usually knew enough things to say to make sure that you were more likely to punch me in the face than to hurt my feelings. I grew up in Venice, which is a beach town out in Los Angeles, and where I grew up, as I was looking around again at, you know, different types of people, when they'd ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I said, a boy. It wasn't as easy to do back then as it is today. And that was one of my first lessons in acceptance. And so when I found out and really accepted that I couldn't be a boy, I had to settle for the next best thing. And the way that I saw the world, that was to be a tough broad. And tough broads in Venice, I've learned in sobriety that geographically tough broads have different standards. So Rochester tough broads might be very different. But in Venice, it's very important that you be in a gang, and I was. It's important that you do a lot of fighting, and I did. It's important that I let all of you know today that I've never won a fight in my life. but I've never fought less than five people at a time. And after I'd been sober for a while, my sponsor explained to me that if you fight one person and you lose, someone might think you're not a very good fighter, but if you always fight groups of five or more, everybody thinks you must be pretty tough, or why would that many people have had to jump you? And so it was just one of those situations where I walked around with my face beat in a lot, but a lot of people thought that I was tough. I never convinced the most important person, that being myself. When I was, very young, And I started with, you know, this wanting to be a boy and all these suicide attempts. We were on welfare, and my mom was able to find out about getting me psychological and psychiatric help, and she began to take me to these professional people. I don't have any kind of diagnosis to give you about why these people thought that I drank the way that I did, or I tried to kill myself the way that I did, or I wanted to be a boy or anything else, because I felt about those people much like my friend Patty Hicks always did. I thought they should have to work for their money, and I never told them anything. I never answered one question. I had nothing to say. I sat there the required period of time, and when it was over, I walked out. I did not have a good attitude, and anyway, one of my favorite things was I would stand out there with my gang down on the boardwalk in Venice Beach, and I would be barefoot because tough broads in Venice don't wear shoes. Tough broads have tough feet, and I would see some touristy-looking people coming and walking towards us, and I would take my cigarette butt, and I would throw it down on the sidewalk, and I would put it out with my bare feet. And I would see these touristy-looking people whisper to one another, and I knew what they were saying. They were saying, "Wow, she is one tough broad." And I was very impressed that I could do this, and I knew they were 100 times more impressed than I was. And again, you know, after I'd been sober for a while, my sponsor explained to me that perhaps what some of those people were saying to one another was, "Did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire. Why would anybody do anything so stupid, you know?" But I didn't really know there was any other way of looking at it other than being tough, and so I did it all the time. Just being able to step on lit cigarette butts with your feet didn't really mean you were tough. You were only truly tough if you were then able to walk upon those feet as if it did not hurt, you know. I've always been very grateful that tattoos were not particularly popular when I was out there on the streets. They were a little popular, but not really, you know. And if they had been, I'd be standing up here tonight, today. I'd have a shark on my arm, and it would swim whenever I did this. I would have gotten something, you know, like a battleship on my chest, or maybe a canoe in my case. But if I had thought that it was tough, I would have done it. I was willing to go to any length. The last time that I got beat up, it was by my own gang, and it was getting time to find some help. But anyway, I was in my mother's apartment. They came and they knocked on the door and they said, "You know, if you come out of the house today, we're going to beat you up." And I immediately opened the door and went outside because I didn't want anybody thinking I was standing in there afraid. I didn't ever let anybody know I was afraid of anything. I refused to acknowledge that emotion. And I started to walk down the street and they started to follow me. And as I walked down the street, I had a choice. I could stay on the street or I could take the alley. And I thought, if I don't take that alley, they'll think it's because I'm afraid to take that alley. And I didn't want anybody thinking I was afraid to do anything. So I took the alley, and they beat me up. And while I was laying in the alley, and they were punching my face and knocking my head against the asphalt, for whatever reason that day, what they wanted was for me to cry. And I don't really know how long they hit me or, you know, whatever. I know they eventually got bored, and they left. And when I got up from that fight, if you had walked up to me and asked me, I would have told you that I won. Because I didn't shed one tear. Not one. You know, and I was the only one who had a black eye. I was the only one who had a swollen lip. I was the only one whose face was bleeding. But in my mind, I won. You know, and that was what was important to me before I came to Formal of Alcoholics Anonymous. It seems a little ridiculous to me right now. You know, I mean, somebody walked up to me and they said, "Hey, June, I'm either going to punch you in the face a few times, you can cry a few tears." I'd cry a few tears. I mean, who cares, you know? But at that point in time, it was a matter of life or death to me. You know, I just didn't have that option. I was brought to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous by my mother. My mother had been in and out of the program for many, many years. And because I often get off on different tangents, I want to let you know that my mother is sober today and has been for a number of years. She is not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She does not attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, but she is sober. And she brought me here. Anyway, she brought me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't ask for help. I didn't want help. I didn't raise my hand. I sat in the meeting. She brought me because she was afraid that if she left me alone, I would get her evicted from another apartment. And after that meeting, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous began for me in that meeting, because after the meeting, I talked to one of the only people in the whole world that I admired. And I admired Paul for a lot of reasons, some of which you may not identify with, but they were what kept me coming back, so I'll share them with you. Paul was from my neighborhood in Venice. He was one of the most hostile and violent men I'd ever known. He'd been in prison. He rode a motorcycle. He had tattoos. He had a knife, had it with him at the meeting that night. And, you know, I looked at him and I just thought, wow, Never thought people this great came to AA, you know. Thought it was just for weak people like my mom, you know. And if I had to tell you what I wanted out of life in one sentence when I came to the program, I wanted the ability to walk into a room full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens. But that was what I wanted, you know. And Paul is the kind of guy that once he'd been drinking, if he walked into a bar or a party and I'd seen him do it, and he wanted to sit at your table, you gave him the table because you just didn't know what he was going to do. He could be that crazy, you know. And so I looked at this man who had achieved everything that I wanted out of life, the ability to clear rooms and tables, and he was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it made a big impression on me. I got drunk the next night, and I came back to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not raise my hand. I was too young to be an alcoholic, and even if I was an alcoholic, I was not going to join an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. So in between the meetings, I spent all my time trying to talk to Paul, because he was the only person cool enough to talk to, and I explained to Paul that I wasn't really an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I was far too young to be an alcoholic, that I had places to go, people to see, things to do. I had my whole life ahead of me, that I wasn't anything like my mother, who was very, very, very alcoholic, and that therefore I was completely non-alcoholic. I later learned that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince other people that they're not alcoholics. You know, they already know that. Paul turned to me and he said, you know, June, he said, I'll tell you, I'm pretty new in this AA thing, and they've told me that I cannot diagnose anyone's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. He said, I've seen the way that you drink, and I've seen the way that you use chemicals, and I happen to believe that if you don't come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and take what these people have to offer you within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't trying to make up something that, you know, for a made-for-TV movie or something. He was just talking about facts. He was talking about things that had happened in my life. He was talking about things that had begun starting to happen, and I knew that he was telling me the truth. And I thought a little bit about what he said, but I did not want to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I just didn't think it was that bad yet. And in that two-week period of time, as I went to those meetings, not raising my hand, absolutely every alternative but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. I was living with my mother at that time. I had been for a short period of time. By the time I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the only person I hated more than my mother was myself. But I hated my mother for everything that had ever gone wrong in my life, and take it from me, in the short version, a lot had gone wrong. And it had been extremely convenient for me throughout the years that I was sober to blame my mother and her alcoholism. It got me out of a lot of times being booked in police stations, a lot of different things, because I knew just how to tell the story, you know? And it was just real easy. And until I got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and started to take the steps and started to learn that if my mother was my problem, I was really in trouble. Because there really wasn't anything I could do about that, you know, and I had to learn to stop being a victim and start looking at my own life. But certainly when I first walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was nowhere near that point. A hell of a lot easier to just blame my mother, which I did. And because of the way that I felt about her, and because of the way that I felt about me, and because of the way I felt about everybody else in the world, I used to physically attack my mother. And when she was drinking, she used to defend herself, but that was really about the extent of it. But right now, at this point, she was sober. And she didn't think that she had to be subjected to being attacked in her own apartment, and she asked me to leave, and I did. I had been in a number of foster homes up to that point. I'd been thrown out of all of them. None of them would take me back. I didn't bother calling any of the rest of my family. I was not allowed to call or come by under any circumstances. I tried to get into some drug rehab and alcohol recovery homes that were available in the LA area at that time. None of them would take me, some because of my age, some just because of my attitude. And then, you know, one day as I was walking down that alley, all five members of my own gang beat me up. And so I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 87 pounds. I had a black eye. I had a swollen lip. I had no shoes. Wouldn't have worn shoes if I'd had them at that time. I had no money. I had no friends. I had no family. I had no place to live. And I raised my hand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can see where it was really kind of simple. It wasn't like, would you like to go to Hawaii or join AA? You know, I mean, it was really easy. When I first raised my hand in meetings, I know today that there were some people at that time who did not know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, which Murph read for us today, particularly the third tradition, the one that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And the reason I'm sure that some of those people didn't know about that tradition at that time was because through my mother, who'd been in and out of the program for so many years, some of the people knew how old I was, and they came up to me after the meetings and they told me I was too young to be an alcoholic. And they told me that they didn't want little kids sitting in their meeting while they were talking about serious things. And they told me that if I came back, they would get together and throw me out. And I thought, you know, that's okay. AA doesn't want me either, but that's okay, because I don't want me either. And I had it for a long, long time. In fact, I could never remember wanting me, you know. And so I went over to a friend of my mother's house, and I went into her bathroom, which is the first place I went at anyone's house I ever visited. And I found enough of the kind of pills to kill myself, and I took enough of them to do it one more time. And then that day before I passed out, I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the time I got to the meeting, I could not stand and I could not sit, so I laid in the meeting. I don't know about where you guys go to meetings here in Rochester, but in West L.A. where I got sober, they almost never call on people to share who were laying in the meeting. The next thing I remember, I was in a hospital. Paul had taken me there, and a doctor was giving me medication to make me throw up and explaining to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart. And had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And I can't tell you why that overdose was any different than all the others I'd inflicted upon myself during the years that I was out there. I just know that it was. Because since that time, one day at a time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. That's how I personally define sobriety. The 13th of July of this past year, I celebrated 21 continuous years of sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. For those of you who are new, I want to be sure that that you know that I never planned on staying here 21 years. When I came into this program, if they had given me an option of whether I wanted to go on living or dying, I would have checked the no box, you know. I just wanted to die. I did not stay in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was afraid of going out on the streets and dying. That's never been what's kept me from going back out there. What's kept me from going back out there is that I might be able to live the way that I lived, you know. I tried to die as long and as hard as I could out there, and I didn't make it. So I got to assume that for me what it means is that I got to live the way that I was living. And let me tell you that by the time I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not have hated myself any more than I did and gone on breathing for another 3 seconds. It was not possible. When I came into this program, I had a bad attitude. It wasn't that I got one after I got sober. I just came here with the only attitude I had ever had. And I did not like women. I didn't like me. I didn't like my mother. I didn't like hugging women. I didn't like sitting next to women. I didn't shake hands with women. And I did not like listening to women speakers, which is something that always makes me feel better because I know there are never as many people listening to me as it looks like. The only men I'd ever known in my life were alcoholics. Most of them were extremely violent, and men in here scared me. I didn't want anything to do with them either, and I had a problem because in July of 1972, when I got sober, all we had in AA were men and women, and I didn't like any of them. But I went to meetings anyway, and I went to 21 meetings a week my first couple of years in sobriety. I got very, very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't because I wanted to get a gold star in AA. It was simply because I wasn't sure if this was going to work for me. I came into this program, and physically I was not in as bad a shape as a number of people that I have seen come in since, although I had a number of physical problems and surgeries that I had to have as a result of my drinking and the abuse that I did on my body after I'd been sober. But mentally, I was really pretty gone. You know, people would start conversations with me, you know, and I'd, "Bird." And that made the old-timers very nervous. I can remember being something, I don't know, maybe 9 months sober or something, and seeing this woman, or a couple months sober, I guess, and seeing this woman take a 9-month chip. And she got up and she said she was feeling really good because the music had finally stopped playing, you know, when the radio wasn't on. And I never told anybody in AA that I heard the music all the time because I thought they'd lock me up in some kind of a mental institution. You know, when I heard her, I thought, God, I should have told somebody. We've probably been listening to the same station, you know? I am extremely grateful for the old-timers and the people that were here when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. They were extremely tolerant of me, and I am just amazed that they were. I don't think I have half as much tolerance today even as they had for me. When I got here, I've given you an idea of the fact that I did have this bad attitude and I didn't like people. Most of all, I didn't like myself. I didn't take baths or showers for a long time after I got sober, partly because I didn't know how often you were supposed to do things like that, and I didn't want to look stupid and ask anybody. I didn't know how many times people washed their hair or brushed their teeth or any of that sort of stuff. But it didn't really matter to me because I didn't want to know, because I didn't want to have to touch myself, because I felt like thrown up all the time at what I was and where I came from. You know, I knew with sobriety, for me, immediately came a tremendous amount of remorse, and I was no longer terribly proud of all the things that I had done and the people that I had hurt and manipulated and done damage to. And they had been numerous, and they were people many times who really were defenseless. And I had been so proud of that before, but in sobriety I wasn't anymore. I had all the feelings for myself that I'd had all my life. I hated the way that I looked. I hated where I came from. And most of all, I hated the way that I felt, always. And yet when I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I listened to people and they shared that through their alcoholism they too had reached a point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and yet through the process of working the program within the confines of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that they had come to a place where they could walk on the sunny side of the street, where they could look other people in the eye and they didn't feel better than and they didn't feel less than, they were just equal. They were one of God's kids. And I listened to that and I thought that could never happen for me. But I did believe there was enough hope and enough inspiration in the people that shared in those stories, because I knew that they couldn't all be lying, you know, that I believed that maybe someday when I was walking down the street and I caught a glance of myself in one of those store windows, you know, where you can see yourself, that maybe I won't feel like throwing up at what I see looking back. And that was enough hope to keep me coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, that maybe this program could take me to a place where one day when I caught a glimpse of myself, I wouldn't feel like throwing up. And that kept me coming back. That was enough for me. And I did, as I said, I got very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group at that time was the Monday night Venice group, and it was a very, very special group, and I never missed it. You know, I mean, I didn't miss a meeting the first year that I was sober. I, as I said, I was going to 21 meetings a week, but they said, you know, you've got to go to a meeting every single day, and I thought they checked. I was several months sober, and I got the mumps. And I didn't go to a doctor. I went to my home group. And I asked a couple of old-timers. I said, I got these lumps back here. What do you think that is? And they felt it, and they said, it's swollen glands. And I said, all right, it's good enough for me. And finally, about a week or a couple days later, I don't know, one of the members of my group said, I'm taking you to a doctor. So they took me to a doctor, and the doctor said, you have the mumps. I said, no, I don't. I have swollen glands. I wasn't going to believe some doctor over an old-timer in my group. He said, I'm telling you, you got the mumps. He said, this is very contagious. Have you been near anybody? And he said, you better let people know. This can be very dangerous for people. So I took out my book, and I called the first guy in my home group, and I said, Keith, this is June. I just want to let you know I exposed you to the mumps. He said, that's okay, kid. You can't keep it unless you give it away. And I didn't miss a meeting, you know. They told us at the Monday Night Venice group it was real important that you get a copy of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Said that they paid, they charged exactly what they paid for it, and they were willing to make liberal credit arrangements, including nothing down and nothing a week. And then at my home group, they didn't say that it's at all the meetings, but at my home group they said, and if you're too afraid to talk to somebody about it, you can just go ahead and steal it. And I thought I'd been stealing longer than I'd been drinking, and I saw that as an unrelated activity as far as sobriety, so I didn't plan on giving that up too. But I was very superstitious, and I thought that stealing a big book from an AA meeting might jinx my sobriety, and so I went to the library in Santa Monica. I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous while I was there. And I stole a copy of the 12 and 12 while I was there. I'd heard a lot of people talk about that one too. And I didn't feel bad about that. Not at that time. I mean, I just thought they had a book. I needed it. I should steal it, you know. And I was sober, I don't know, a few years or whatever when I realized I had to make amends for that. And I had about 25 other library books I'd stolen over the years, great classics like Misty the Seahorse and things like that, you know. Not easy for a tough bride from Venice to walk in with 25 books, including Misty the Seahorse, and explain that, you know, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's necessary for my sobriety to return these books. And I wanted to know if I could make payments because they wanted 3 to 5 cents a day, and I'd had some of the books for, you know, 11 years or something. And she said, that's fine. She said, you know, I used to work at this library in Laguna Beach. This man came in, and he'd stolen the big book, too. And she said, I guess you guys do this all the time. And just another one of the many times when I realize that I'm not unique in anything I've ever done or thought about here in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the meetings that I attended regularly, which I know Earl's been to, and I think Ted and, you know, a number of people, but was the Tuesday night Westwood meeting, and they made me the greeter there. And so I would stand there at the door, and I was barefoot most of my first 2 years. I wore motorcycle chains on my wrists and my ankles. I wore a motorcycle jacket that on the back said, "Do unto others," and then "Split." It was my own little AA slogan. Smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day and lit all of them myself. Occasionally someone would hold a match. I allowed them to hold it as long as they liked, but they never lit my cigarette with it. And after I'd been sober a short period of time, I took up smoking cigars and later a pipe. So I would stand there at the door, my motorcycle chains and jacket, barefoot, with my cigar, welcoming the newcomers as they came to AA. Sometimes as they'd walk by, I'd hear their sponsor say, "You see, if you keep drinking, you can end up like that." When I got sober, people were guessing my age. They were guessing me at 37 in the first few months. I still had my black eye and my swollen lip, and I was 87 pounds. And I was 13 at the time. I did not know anymore. I was unable to read. I was unable to carry any kind of a conversation. When I say that I couldn't read, I don't mean that I couldn't say the words on a page. I just mean that I couldn't hold all the words in one sentence in my mind. And that took a lot of years in sobriety before that, whatever that is, that function, came back. So because of the way that I looked, I had a very limited vocabulary when I got sober. Consisted almost solely of profanity. There were a few exceptions, the and mother. A lot of people in AA I found were very offended by that type of language, and so I tried to use it more when they were around. And what I want to let you know is, if you choose to smoke the way that I did, to dress the way that I did, and to talk the way that I did, you too can sit in a meeting, certainly not this large, but fairly large, and have an entire row all to yourself. There were a whole lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous didn't want anything to do with that kind of behavior, and I don't blame them a bit. You can be assured that the people who became my sponsors were people who had been trained to never say no to an AA request. I was not baby of the year of 1972. I was thinking as I was looking around this room, I don't know very many people here, although there's at least one person who sent me a letter, and I'm looking forward to meeting her a little bit later on, and a couple other people that I met real quick today. But, you know, I was looking around, and I was just thinking about one of my favorite parts of Alcoholics Anonymous, if not my favorite thing about it, is what it talks about in the book when it says, "We are people who normally would not mix." It has been one of the greatest gifts for me. I can't tell you how many people have touched my life that I would have had absolutely nothing to do with them had it not been for a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I don't know, just two of them just kind of flashed across my mind, you know, in different ways. One of them was my sponsor, and Gail Wilson was my sponsor, and like I said, you know, she didn't want to say no to an AA request when I asked her to be my sponsor. It's really weird that I would have gotten a woman as a sponsor. I have to tell you a little bit about that because I've given you an idea of how I felt about women. And I went to these 21 meetings a week. It seemed like Gail Wilson spoke at about 17 of them every week. So I thought to myself, perhaps if I asked this woman to be my sponsor, I could find out ahead of time where she's speaking, and then I won't have to go hear her all the time. And that was the spiritual motivation I had for asking a woman to be my sponsor. Gail and I were the type of people that the Big Book says normally would not mix. Gail was almost 3 times my age. She was from Kentucky. She had come from a very warm and loving family with a mother and a father in it. She not only did not use the type of language that I used, she didn't know what a lot of the words I was using meant. And she was seen in public wearing pink on numerous occasions. So there were just a whole lot of reasons why, you know, I didn't wear pink until I was over 10 years sober. Nothing pink, ever, no way. Today I have the freedom to wear pink if I choose to. But Gail became my sponsor. I would see her at my home group today. My home group is the Thursday Night Brentwood Workshop, and I would see Gail at the Brentwood meeting, and she would say, "June, don't sit next to me at the meeting tonight." She said, "I can't take the cigar smoke." And I'd say, "Okay," and I'd turn to go find a seat, and she'd say, "And June, please don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor." And that was fine with me because I didn't want anyone knowing I was hanging out with someone lame like her, you know. And we would meet secretly after meetings and talk about AA, you know. Anyway, after I'd been sober for a while, I got an opportunity to go to school, and I started going to school one day at a time. And one of the reasons that I went was I wanted to take this a class so that I could learn to read, and I took this class that at the school they call the dummy English class, and I signed up for it and I showed up one day at a time every time the class was scheduled. I sat there the required period of time, just like I was taught to sit in AA meetings, whether I wanted to be there or not, whether I liked the people there or not, whether I felt like it would help me or not, you know, whatever. I just showed up. And I finished that class, and I went ahead and I took some other classes. And I did that one day at a time, and at the end of a couple of years, they called me in the office at the college that I was attending, and they told me I'd completed all the requirements for what they called an AA college degree. Now, I thought that was a nice name for a college degree. I had never planned on getting a college degree. It was one of those things, you know, when they say make a list of the things you might want when you get sober, it wouldn't have even been on my list. It wouldn't have even occurred to me. But it was something that I was really amazed and impressed with Alcoholics Anonymous, because I had come here and I had never finished anything in my life. I had never shown up for a week straight anything in my life until I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And even after I got sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, it's funny, at the question and answer meeting, you know, they asked about whether it's true that young people are not stable or something like that, you know, and Earl was, you know, was laughing about that. I think anybody knew is not really high in the stable department, in my opinion. But anyway, I was definitely not stable. In fact, I was an absolute flake in every area of my life for many years after I got sober, with one exception. That was as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was taught when I got here that you show up where you say you're going to show up, and you show up on time, and you try and look as best as you can, you know. And I've done that throughout the time that I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that it is such an important foundation stone of my being able to stay sober that I cannot tell you. And it's been even more than that. You know, I suppose in some ways when it talks about, you know, we practice these principles in all our affairs, you know, it's like it permeated all these other areas of my life. You know, I just learned to show up in AA meetings, but I didn't show up at work. I thought, they're not in AA, I just go to AA, you know. But after a while, I remember, you know, I was many years sober and I had this job, and I suddenly realized I never called in sick. I just was showing up all that. I couldn't even believe it. I was, you know, shocked at my behavior. And it's something that has, like I said, it's just permeated every area of my life. I just show up, you know, in all different kinds of things. And it's given me just an incredible life. Anyway, going back to when I finished that school, I went ahead and I completed another couple of years of college one day at a time. And my sponsors had told me that any dreams I had were possible here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I went ahead and I did the footwork that my sponsors taught me I had to do, whether I be in or out of AA. And I did that footwork. I received a telegram. It's been over 10 years ago now, telling me that I'd been accepted as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. And I'll tell you, when I got sober, I always planned on spending a lot of time in court, but never on that side of the table. You know, I went ahead and I completed law school. I was scheduled to complete law school in May of 1983, and in April of 1983, my sponsor Gail died of cancer at 48 years old. And during those last couple of months, I was able to show up at the hospital, and I spent a lot of time with Gail in those months. You know, she was in the hospital most of the time, and so I tried to go by a lot, and so did lots of other people. She was never alone, You know, when we would sit there, you know, different nurses, lots of nurses came in, and Gail never missed an opportunity while we would sit there to introduce me to these strangers who had absolutely no interest whatsoever in meeting me, you know. But she would say, "Nurse Taylor, I want you to meet Junie." She said, "You know, Junie's like a daughter to me, and she's going to be an attorney," you know. And Gail and I would, you know, we would sit there and we'd talk, and I'd, you know, I mean, because it's so amazing, you know, this was the same woman who used to say, "Don't sit next to me at the meeting and don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor." You know, now she's stopping people in the hallway, "Hey, come here, I want you to meet Junie," you know. And we talked about that, you know, we talked about how that could come about. And she said, you know, June, she said, I never believed in you. She said, I never believed you were going to stay sober. I never believed AA could work for someone like you, who came from where you came from with as much anger and as much hatred as you had towards yourself and everyone in the world. She said, but I didn't tell you. She said, because I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so she said, I just tried to add what I could to your life in the way that I had been taught and in the way that people had added to mine. And she said, and I remember when you called me up and you said, you know, I'm going to go to college, Gail. She said, I knew you'd never finish. She said, you never finished anything. I knew you'd never show up and do it. She said, but I didn't say anything. She said, because I believed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, and then I remember when you called and you said, Gail, I think I'm going to go to law school and be an attorney. She said, I had to force myself not to laugh out loud. She said, you know, it takes 7-8 years. I knew you couldn't do it, you know. She said, but I didn't say anything because I believed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I think that's really something that I try and remember a lot of times when people come up to me, you know. There aren't really a whole lot of, you know, you can'ts around here. Impossible things happen. They've happened in my life. They happen in everybody's life that I have seen, you know, let the program of Alcoholics Anonymous experience affect their lives. Anyway, Gail did pass away. And, you know, it was interesting because my grandmother died when I was 9 years old, and that was a major turning point in my life. Before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that was the end of God for me, and I didn't have anything to do with God until long after I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. To give you an idea of how I felt about God when I was sober, I had to go to court because after I'd gotten sober, my mother had turned me in, and I had a court date coming up, and I was at my home group. And the night before I went to my home group, I was talking to this guy who's a good friend of mine, still is my best and longest friend in the program, Mike. And I said to Mike, I said, you know what, Mike, I got to go to court tomorrow. And he said, would you say a prayer for me? And he said, sure, kid. He said, I'm going to pray for God's will for you. And I said, don't do that. I thought you were my friend. And that was how I felt about, you know, it's like, geez, you know, I mean, I was 11 months sober, and I cannot tell you how hard it was for me to read the words of that third step prayer. I don't know why, but I somehow felt if I didn't say it, you know, then maybe God wouldn't get involved in my life, and I really didn't want him to, because I knew that, you know, that our score was not even, and I had a lot of pain back to do, you know. But when my grandmother died, I just saw that God took my grandmother, and that was it. I had nothing else, you know, to do with this higher power. And when Gail died, because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was very, very sad, and I grieved, and I still miss her very, very much today. But I am ever so grateful that I got sober in 1972 so that I could have 11 years with Gail W., you know, because a lot of people didn't get to be with Gail. They got their own sponsors, and they got their own people, and they're very, very special, you know, just like you got your own people here in Rochester. But I got to have 11 years with Gail. And I started to realize that, you know, I had been typically self-centered and self-obsessed, because when I lost my grandmother, I never thought about the fact that my mother lost her mother, my aunt lost her mother, you know, all these other people lost someone too. I never saw it that way. I just saw my loss, you know, just me, and that was it. You know, I didn't care about anybody else. I didn't want to add anything to anybody else. I didn't want to be sympathetic to anybody else. Nobody had pain like I had pain, you know, and that was one of the greatest old ideas that I've had to work through here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous as one of the biggest snobs I have ever met before or since, and I didn't even know it, because I didn't fit into the typical snob category. I'll give you a little bit of an example. Well, you know, I didn't like anybody who had a car. I'd never had a car, and I figured if you had a car, you know, you didn't come from where I came from. You didn't hurt like I hurt. I didn't want anything to do with you. I didn't have a father, so if you had a mother and a father, that's it. You know, nothing to do with you either. And, you know, if you didn't come from, like, exactly where I came from, I mean, I just didn't like you, you know. If you wore makeup, I didn't have anything to do with you. I didn't wear makeup. You know, if you dressed nice, you know, I knew you had money, and if you had money, you didn't have pain, and if you didn't have pain, then you didn't have anything to do with me. You know what I mean? I couldn't write off everybody. And when my sponsor, Gail, she got this new baby. You know how it is when your sponsor gets a new baby. You know, it's not a great thrill for you. So Gail gets this new baby, Linda. Linda is and was one of the most physically beautiful women I've ever seen in my life. She's a stewardess. absolutely gorgeous. She's blonde. I mean, I'm telling you, if she walked in the room, half of us would turn around and we would just stop for just a moment. She's unbelievable, you know? So Gail's going to sponsor her. That's fine. Gail can sponsor whoever she wants to, you know? Well, then Gail calls me up. She says, I want you to be Linda's friend. I thought, why? What does she need a friend for, you know? I thought, I don't want to go to meetings with her. You know, I was still single. I thought, Christ, I'll just get trampled with all the guys coming over to give her a big book, you know? I mean, she said, you know, I want you to be your friend. I said, I don't want to be your friend. She's a lady. I got nothing in common. I'm a tough broad from Venice. I got nothing in common with her, you know? And Gail, who was, she could be very rough. She said, you know, June, she said, did it ever occur to you that when you try and kill yourself, whether you're in an alley in Venice or you're in a hotel room in Paris, you have to feel exactly the same way? No, it never did occur to me. She said, well, maybe you ought to think about that, and I expect you to start taking Linda to some meetings and be her friend. I thought, Jesus, talk about willing to go to any length. So, anyway, Linda is one of my closest friends today, and we came from very, very different places to get here, and we definitely normally would not have mixed. Anyway, I did finish law school, and I don't know. Let's see. Well, I could talk about a couple of things. In order to pass the bar in any given state, in order to practice law, you have to pass the bar in any given state that you might want to practice. I was planning to practice in the state of California, which is the only state I've ever really lived in, and I went ahead and I took the bar exam in California in July of that year. I studied. I showed up for all the classes. I did all the homework I was supposed to do. I did all the studying I was supposed to do. I kept myself spiritually in contact with the higher power. I went to the meetings where I had commitments, and I showed up for the test 3 days in a row, took the test, and I got the results in December of 1983 that I did not pass the bar exam. And I could not believe it. I could not believe it. There wasn't one thing I could think of that I could have done extra to help me study for that test, and I did not pass it. I just couldn't believe it, and I felt like a failure. I was 10 years sober. I didn't have a dollar to put in the basket. I could not pay my rent. I had borrowed thousands of dollars, you know, to get through school. I couldn't get a job because when you don't pass the bar, you can't get a job, you know, and here I am. I just couldn't believe it. You know, I get a 12-step call from central office. It's like, oh, sure. So I go and I pick up this woman. I bring her back to my apartment. We're sitting there, and she's kind of sobering up, but she's crying. And she says, I don't have a job. And I said, I don't either. She says, well, I don't know if I'm going to be able to pay my rent next month. And I said, I don't either. And she said, how long have you been sober? You know, I'm like, geez, like 10 and a half years, but it's really a good program, you know. Anyway, I talked to my best friend Mike. I had to go and I had to go speak at a meeting that night, but I got that letter. I'll tell you, if there was ever a time I didn't want to show up, it was that night, but I showed up. And after the meeting, Mike and I went out and we talked. And I showed Mike the telegram, and I said, and I know what it means too, Mike. I said, well, what's it mean, June? I said, it means that, you know, this is all a joke. God's will is, you know, not for me to be an attorney. You know, people don't come from where I came from and, you know, and do that. It was just a big, you know, joke I played on myself. I can't do that. So what the, you know, telegram says is, you know, give up and go back and be the waitress that you've been. You know how to do it. You're happy. It'll be okay. And Mike said, well, let me see the telegram. And he looked at it. He said, well, I think it says you should take the test again. It doesn't say that, you know, and he just like kept repeating it, you know, and that's the kind of thing that sponsors will do. They'll try and talk to him about a problem and they just don't understand, you know. It's like, you know, I can remember, well, anyway, you know, he just kept saying, you know, you just got to take the test again. I said, well, I don't have any money. I can't pay my rent. You know, I owe thousands of dollars. You know, I'm a failure, you know, financially. I'm a failure, you know, in AA, and I don't feel particularly spiritual right now either. You know, I mean, I don't want to drink, and that's a big miracle, you know. I said, but I'm certainly not happy. You know? And he said, well, that's okay. He said, you know, why don't you just borrow some more money? You already owe more than you can pay as it is, and go ahead and take the test again. And we argued, you know, for quite a while about what the telegram really meant, you know. And it was, you know, like I said, I remember being, you know, new, you know, and you'd call your sponsor up and you'd say, okay, look, you know, my rent is due tomorrow, and I don't have any money. And they'd say, why don't you go to a meeting? I'd say, all right, look. You've been sober a little too long. Maybe I said that fast. Let me run it by you one more time and try and give you a little bit more of the detail. My rent is due tomorrow. Okay, are you with me so far? Come on. Okay. And my landlord, by the way, is not in AA, okay? Okay, so they need the money tomorrow. Now, what do I do? Why don't you go to a meeting? You know, and it's like you could walk up to somebody on the street and say, excuse me, what time is it? And they say, it's a horse. You know, it's no help at all. And yet you just kind of do it, and somehow it all works out. So anyway, I thought, you know, I listened to Mike, and I went ahead and I studied for the test exam. The test, again, I studied as hard as I could. I showed up every single day for all the studying. I did all the work. I showed up at the meetings that I had commitments at, tried to keep a spiritual contact with a higher power on a daily basis to the best of my ability. I showed up for the test. I took the test. I got took it in February of 1984. I got a letter in June of 1984 that I had passed. And I was also notified that even passing is not enough to practice law. You then have to be sworn in, which is really just another way to get $150 more dollars out of you. But anyway, they were having the swearing-in ceremony on my sponsor, Gail Wilson's AA birthday. And so that was the day that I got sworn in to practice law. But, you know, I would love to be able to tell you that when I got that telegram, you know, that I felt the same. But I just, you know, I felt so much more spiritual when I got the telegram that I passed, you know. I had a much greater conscious contact with my higher power, and it was... I want to talk about one other area of my life. I guess Mary was talking in the meeting about getting involved in a relationship, you know, when she was 93 days sober. And I have thought many times that the person that I'm in a relationship with today would never have been in a relationship with me for many, many years, you know, after I got sober. I was not good relationship material, you know, and I didn't know that for a long time, but I think I should, you know, give you a little bit of an idea. See, this is kind of the way I did relationships. I would meet someone, and we would, you know, be involved, I guess, and I, you know, basically this is the way I would deal with the relationship. I'd say, okay, look, I don't need you. I don't care about you. And it doesn't matter to me whether you live or die. Now, what I was waiting for was for the guy that I was with who I'd said these things to, basically, to say to me, you know, June, I really love you. I care about you. I think you're a wonderful person, and I'd like to spend the rest of my life with you. And then I was going to say, me too. That's really how I feel, you know. The funny thing is that almost never happened. You'll find it never happened to me. And so, you know, I just kept having, like, some disastrous kind of relationships. And I got involved. I don't remember how long I was sober. I got involved in a relationship, and I stopped trying to work on the relationship with a higher power because it was much easier to talk to my boyfriend. And I thought he could just kind of take that place. And then he dumped me, and I was quite shocked, and I had never been dumped because I'd never been in a relationship because I didn't, you know, I didn't do emotional things. And this really hurt, and so I was sitting there, and I was thinking, well, you know, I'm going to have to kill myself, you know, because I had never dealt with pain. So I thought, yeah, I guess that's it. I mean, I don't know how to deal with pain. I've never dealt with it sober. I didn't deal with it very well when I was drinking, and I'm going to have to kill myself. And right then, there was a knock at my door. This guy in AA, I opened the door, and I said, hi, Bob, how you doing? He says, fine. He says, are you ready? I said, what are you talking about, Bob? He said, I told you a couple weeks ago, Central Office had asked me take a group of people over to this local school and tell them a little bit about Alcoholics Anonymous, and you said you'd go with me. And I said, well, Bob, I said, I'll tell you, I said, experience, strength, and hope I really don't have right now. I was just going to go in the bathroom and kill myself. And he said, oh, really? He said, have you had dinner? And I said, no. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. He said, why don't you come with me to the meeting? We'll get something to eat. We'll go to the meeting. He said, you don't have to, it's not a meeting, but we'll go to the school. You don't have to say anything. He said, and then afterwards, I'll bring you home. You can kill yourself. And I said, okay. So we took off and we went over to the meeting, and on the way to the meeting I wouldn't talk to him because, you know, and I wouldn't let him play the radio because if you do that you could get distracted and begin to feel better. So you don't want to talk to somebody when you're in that kind of pain if you want to really experience the pain. And when you're experiencing this pain, if you want to really experience the maximum amount of pain, which takes a tremendous amount of concentration, you have to concentrate on the fact that not only are you feeling this pain now, not only has this person left you, but you have to recognize and totally feel the pain of knowing that there will never be anyone else again. And if you don't get there, you haven't really gotten as far as you can go. So, you know, I was deep in thought, and we pulled up at this school. We were walking over to where the room was, and this woman walked up to me, and she said, excuse me. She said, do you know where room 525 is or something? I said, no. I tried to hurry up and get back into my pain. She said, well, do you think you could help me find it? I thought, all right. So I'm walking her around the school, and we got lost, and I didn't know it any better than she did, and she started to talk to me, and she said, I'm taking, you know, a drama class. I was like, oh, great. She said, well, what kind of class do you, I don't talk much when I don't, you know, feel good. You have to really draw me out in a conversation. So what kind of class are you taking? I said, well, I'm not really taking a class. So well, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm here with some people. We're going to talk a little bit about alcoholism. She said, really? For it or against it? So, well, I guess you'd say against it, you know. I never really heard of any talks for alcoholism. And she said, really? She said, you know, I'm on the wagon. I said, that's great. I said, I know a lot of people on the wagon. They usually fall off. I said, but that's, you know, that's wonderful. And she said, well, why would you be giving that kind of a talk? And I said, because I'm an alcoholic. And I said, I stay sober one day at a time through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like to go to a meeting sometime? And she said, yes, she would. And we traded numbers, made arrangements to go to a meeting the next night. Obviously, I couldn't go home and kill myself. She'd think AA didn't work. So I took Kay to lots and lots of meetings. Kay did not get sober at that time, although she just celebrated 18 continuous years this past August. Kate has every bit as much to do with my still being here sober tonight, today, as I did with her being here. It talks about in the book, when all else fails, try working with another alcoholic. And I can't recommend that highly enough. You know, it is the only thing that can get me out of the self-centered, self-seeking kind of pain that I am able to get myself in when I get that way, you know. If you get to Alcoholics Anonymous and you're single, you're probably going to have to date. I thought that was bad news when I found that out. And I did at 13 come to AA single, which I wasn't happy about. But, you know, and we were talking, I guess Maureen and I were talking about the, before the meeting, she was saying, you know, I talk about my AA dates, you know, out in California, like a guy will ask you out and then you'll go to a meeting. You know, I mean, where else would you go on a date, you know? And then after the meeting, you go to coffee and you talk about the meeting. And then by the time they take you home, you don't know whether to kiss them goodnight or say the Lord's Prayer. And so I had a lot of those kind of dates. When I was 7 years sober, I got involved in a relationship, and it was the first person in my life I ever told that I cared, and he left me for a younger woman, and I thought I was going to die. It was the only time in my sobriety. I've been very fortunate that the obsession to drink was taken away, and at 7 years sober was the only time that it came back in any way. It did not come back as fully as I had it before. And I realized that 7 years sober that for me, I was going to have to make some major changes in my life, that I was going to have to surrender to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in a way that I had not done up to that point, that I was going to have to give up being tough, give up not caring, give up trying to not let anyone know how I felt or what I thought, that I was going to have to trust in the statement that Gail had made to me so many times, you know, which was that there was a difference between being tough and being strong. And I thought she was just, you know, playing with words, and she didn't know anything about being tough, so she wouldn't say that, you know. But at 7 years sober, I decided that I was going to give up trying to be a tough broad, that I was going to try and do it your way. I was going to stop trying to control my emotions, and then I was going to just try and be one of God's kids. And it sounds in some ways, you know, like an easy decision, but it was a very, very difficult one, because all I'd ever wanted to be in my life was a tough broad. I didn't know that there was anything else in me, and I thought if I gave that up, I would just evaporate. But I went ahead and I decided to try something different, and I surrendered my old ideas about what was weak. And today I can tell you that I'm as untough as I have ever been in my life, and yet I'm stronger than I've ever been. One of the interesting paradoxes to me, I can't explain it, I can just tell you that it's true, is that up until that point in sobriety and all my life before coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was so worried, you know, that someone would hurt my feelings that I tried to make sure nobody knew I had any. And my feelings got hurt all the time, and I couldn't show it. And since that time, when I decided to try what Gail suggested about learning to be strong instead of learning to be tough, there are more people in the world today who can hurt my feelings and who know it than there have ever been in the entire, you know, history of my life. And yet my feelings almost never get hurt anymore. You know, that's not to say that they don't. I'm just saying that they get hurt a lot less now that I've let people know they can hurt them than they used to get hurt when I told everybody that they could never be hurt. And it doesn't make sense. It just works. It's just true for me. In law school, this guy asked me out, and I didn't want to go out with him because he'd never been to prison and he didn't have any tattoos. But I went ahead and I went out with him. And we went out for quite a while. Well, we've been together 12 years. And, you know, by that time I had gotten to a point in my life where I could look in mirrors, where I didn't want to trade places with anybody else, you know, where I didn't wish I had your mother, where I didn't wish I had your job, where I didn't wish I had your hair, where I didn't wish I was stacked, you know, where I didn't wish I was anything but what I was, you know, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and everything that you and my higher power had made me. Anyway, we began to go out, and in November of 1988, we got married, and I walked down the aisle to When Irish Eyes Are Smiling, and I had shopped many hours to get the right shoes, because I wear shoes now. And when I walked down that aisle, every member of my family was there. They had all had to pay money to get there because they lived in other states or countries. Two people who were there had never come to this country. They came from Canada, which is where my family is from, to represent my grandparents who had both passed away. And as I walked down the aisle, there wasn't anybody there that, you know, that should have been there that wasn't there, you know? And I thought, you know, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, my family wouldn't have accepted a non-collect phone call from me. You know what I mean? And they paid money to all be there, to all share, you know. And I am ever so grateful, you know, that I worked the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to get to the point, you know, where I have a family today, you know, and I have a relationship with my family. Alcoholics Anonymous is my family, too, and it always will be. I was over 5 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous before I was able to reestablish any kind of relationship with my own family. I didn't get invited to Christmas. I didn't get invited to Thanksgiving. I was not wanted, you know, and it had a lot to do with my own behavior, but I couldn't see it then. I only saw the victim part of me, you know, and today I can see the part that I played in that. And I am a valuable member of my own family today. I am an asset. And, you know, my aunt, who I'm extremely close with, came with me here this weekend, and she was upstairs in the room taking care of my two daughters that I've had since getting married. I was never going to have kids. I was told by many doctors after sobriety that because they, when people sometimes say that one of my kids looks a little bit like me, you know, I'm not insulted. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'm kind of, you know, it's like I'm kind of cute, you know. And she's very cute. But when a couple of years ago, my aunt called me up, and she was crying, and I don't know that I had ever heard her or seen her cry. She's kind of more like an older sister to me, and we've gotten very, very close through the years in sobriety. But she called me up, and she was crying because her stepson, my cousin, who was a year older than me, had hung himself, and his wife and two kids had found him. And she called and asked me to come and be there with them. And I went out there, and they only live an hour from where I live. And I was in a lot of pain from losing my cousin. But I knew that I was nowhere near the kind of pain that my uncle was at 67 years old to lose his 31-year-old son, you know. And I knew that I wasn't in as much pain as my aunt was in, or as his wife and those two little kids were, you know. And I had learned to see that other people are affected by life, not just June, you know. Some of the self-centeredness had lifted, at least at that time. And I went there, and I was able to be of service. I was there because they wanted me to be there. You know, but I did other things that I've learned here. You know, I made food, you know, because I'm good at being busy. That's what I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, shake hands, make coffee, put the, you know, ashtrays on the seats, you know, whatever it is. Those things have saved my life. And I'll tell you, you know, the thing that took me from the way that I hated about myself to the way that I feel about myself today, it wasn't, you know, going to beauty classes, although I've looked at a few books and had some friends help me. It wasn't getting a new haircut, although I have found a haircut I like, you know. It wasn't learning to put on makeup, although I have learned to put on makeup. It wasn't looking at fashion magazines, although I look at them and I have fun playing around with clothes, you know. It was doing the things that I was taught to do here in Alcoholics Anonymous, like cups and ashtrays and showing up, you know, and sweeping the floor and, you know, showing up whether I wanted to or not and picking up newcomers whether I liked them or not, you know, or whether I liked me or not or whether I had a dollar or not or whatever it was, you know. And it was that that gave me the very first self-esteem I ever had, because somewhere along the line, and I think it was around 5 years sober, and I hope it's never so long for anyone else, you know, but I remember thinking I hated everything about myself. I hated where I came from. I hated how I felt still most of the time. But the one thing that I felt good about was I was a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me, it was the first time I ever had self-worth or self-esteem. It was the only thing good about me. And from that point, through continuing to do those things, I've been able to build upon that. And it talks about in the book, you know, that the purpose of this book, I'm a terrible quoter, but something along the lines of, you know, the purpose of this book is to do these 12 steps so that we can fit ourselves to maximum usefulness to God and His kids, you know. And I'm able to get out there today, and I'm able to be useful, you know. And I am a member of my home group, first and foremost, the Brentwood Workshop. I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing. I am a member of my family, you know. I am learning to be a mother one day at a time by showing up. You know, I am a member of my marriage, and I contribute to it, you know. And this is not to say I'm great. I can be a real bitch, you know, but I'm working on it, you know. And the thing is that Norm Alpe, who some of you may have heard, was a person who, for me, gave the best AA talk I've ever heard. And I hope that sometime maybe you can get a tape and hear his message, because for me it was very, very special, and maybe it will be for you too. But Norm Alpe used to always say when he would close, and I'm going to steal it because I've given him credit like you always say you have to, he would say that, you know, it was a long, long walk from where he came from to where he was today, you know. And that's certainly true for me, because you don't get from the streets of Venice Beach to where I am today. It's not possible, you know. But for the grace of God, people like you in rooms like this, in a program and principles called Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I could have missed it all. Thank you.